N-1, a K-pop Demon Hunters podfic, written and read to you by Fens and Marshes. It takes Rumi 10 seconds to realize she isn't in her bedroom. It takes her 2 minutes to realize that, no, actually, she is. It just isn't the bedroom she remembers. It's fuzzy, she thinks, heart in her throat. She knows who she is. She knows, with a too familiar cocktail of pride and regret, what she is, 3 times over, demon and idol and hunter. The where eludes her. She is alone in a penthouse apartment, but not one she recognizes. But they're her own sheets on the bed, the ones she had bought after Zoe dragged her to Muji, and Rumi spent a solid hour touching all the different bedsheets to gauge whether she could tolerate their texture. That's her own bedside table, but books stacked on it that she's never heard of. When she slips out of bed to prowl around the room, feeling oddly like some sort of ghost, the carpet is soft beneath her bare feet. She glances down and freezes. Rumi is wearing loose pajama shorts that fall to her knees. This is fine. This should not be a problem. But her knees, her shins, her calves, even her bare fucking feet are patterned. Like her markings had decided in the night that her upper body was not enough and it was time to swallow her whole. They glow with a haunting, unfamiliar iridescence, as though they're mocking her. She stumbles hard, more uncoordinated than she has ever been, and sits down in the middle of the carpet, in the strange bedroom that must be her own. This is not... She had not gone to sleep like this. They hadn't been there when she... Had they? She doesn't remember going to sleep. She knows who she is. She knows what she is, 3 times over. She does not remember the where, but she can put 2 and 2 together. At some point, she has lost her memory. It has been longer than she realized. This room has the trappings that prove it's Rumi's own. Her prints on the wall and, when Rumi wobbles to her feet to go search the bedside table, an unfamiliar journal labeled within a familiar system. Number 9, 2026. Last she remembers, she had been up to... What does she... She does not remember being up to number 9, or to 2026. Rumi yanks the journal from the drawer and slams it shut, trembling faintly, before tossing it onto the bed. She can read it next, for clues. That's priority number 2. Priority number 1 is getting dressed, getting covered, so that she can stop shaking. She catches a glimpse of herself in a full-length mirror across the room, cringes away from her own reflection out of habit, and then forces herself to look so she knows how bad it is. Guilt and dread coalesce sludgily in the back of her throat, too liquid to swallow away, too solid to ignore. Her patterns are everywhere. Literally, there is no part of her untainted. Her forearms, her hands, her face. She does not know what her future self or her current non-amnesiac self does to hide the markings on her face, but it must be close at hand, since Rumi must do it every day. She flings open the doors to her wardrobe and begins flicking through unfamiliar clothes with still trembling, iridescent hands. Cropped jacket. Shorts. Crop top. A gauzy skirt that would come to her knees but obscure very little, intended for layering and, she thinks, not intended for fighting in. Cropped hoodie, denim shorts, workout shorts, cropped, cropped, cropped. Where the fuck are her winter clothes, she thinks foolishly. And then, more pressingly, what does she do in summer? Because there must be something, some way to hide them. Loose, long-sleeved cotton shirts, maybe. Billowy pants she could pass off as a fashion choice. And her face, veils? No, unsustainable. Makeup. It must be makeup. Rumi stumbles defeatedly back from the utterly useless contents of her wardrobe. When would she even get the chance to wear these fucking shorts outside her own lockable bedroom if her patterns have spread by 2026 to her entire body? Does she play dress up in the mirror where nobody else can see? She crumples onto the bed, poring at her journal, and flips it open. Her heart is rabbiting too fast for her to trust herself to leave the room. No. She worms her way under the covers, the tension unspooling from her somewhat when she assures herself the worst of it is hidden beneath the blankets, and sticks her nose into her own journal to snoop. To search for clues. Names she doesn't know. Award shows she can only dream of winning. Not a mention of the word golden anywhere, fucking obviously, since Rumi is worse rather than better, marked rather than cleansed. She's squinting at a passage she can't pass. What does she mean, working on hexes via Nihonmun? An odd juxtaposition of words which make no sense together. When the door, which should be locked, creaks open. Rumi squeaks, at first innocently startled, and then the fear dropping hard into her stomach. Her arms are bare, but she whips them back under the covers as someone sticks her head into the room. She should not be afraid. She misses... Who does she miss? She does not know where she is. She's so afraid. All she has is that her shoulders, at least, are hidden under the blankets. The worst parts of her are safely tucked away. Oni? The woman says, bewildered, shuffling properly into Rumi's bedroom with an odd little tilt to her head like she's concerned. A breath behind her, another woman appears in the doorway. Rumi blinks at them for a second too long as the fear whirls up and through her, and then, as it ebbs, recognition seeps back in. Her girls. Her girls who she had, for a moment, not recognized. Fuck. They look older. Happier, Rumi thinks. There's a lightness to Mira's posture, even as she scowls at Rumi with the face that means, what are you doing? And Zoe seems somehow more settled, centered, despite the shadow cast over her by concern. They look older than she remembers. She can't quite place how old she remembers them being. It's all so blurry, not blurry like through a window pane or a photo filter, but blurry like a formless shape you can just make out in the fog. There's something there, but all you can place is its size, and how far away it is from you. Around you, the world yawns wide open. The fog makes it impossible to see who is watching you. All you can rely on is the fact that you're alone. Zoe and Mira are both just looking at her, with a deliberate stillness to them like they think any wrong move might startle Rumi out of her skin. For a too long moment, she looks back at them, uncertain, opening her mouth to explain because, if nothing else, her girls, her hunters, will help her. She remembers that sensation of trust, barred from the word unconditional by that single stain of a condition. The confusion of it sits thickly on her tongue as she tries to shape her explanation into something approximating words. Then, made bashful by the sensation of being observed and struggling with the eye contact, she breaks away to glance down at herself. Rumi remembers falling through the frozen over surface of the Han River into the black water beneath it, once. It had been one of Celine's drills. The three of them wobbled over the ice and leveled their weapons at Celine and, when she began tossing stuffed animals at them, a cheaper alternative to fresh practice dummies now that they were skilled enough to hit their targets every time, stumbled around on the ice with varying degrees of success. It had made Mira giggle every time one of them fell on their faces. Even Rumi, despite Celine's quelling stare, couldn't help but laugh. One moment it had felt almost childish, fumbling around with her friends, and the next Rumi had been plunged into sub-freezing water. She doesn't even remember the ice breaking underfoot, just that it had been there and then gone. It's like that now, the instant shock to her system, the aching of the cold, the way an innocent moment goes sinister. Rumi had not processed. Her marks, as she remembers them, would have been hidden by the clothes she's wearing, but she sees the glow in her periphery and is reminded. Most of her is below the blanket still, but her hands are bared, tainted. Her face, as she blinks too dopily at them, like a bird too stupid to move out of the way of a car because it has forgotten it has the ability to fly. Her face, as Mira and Zoe are both looking her fully in the eye. Her face, as fear rises choking and immediate in Rumi's throat, like the tide lurching in and swallowing a beach whole. When she moves, it's less a considered course of action, and more that the animal fear going through her is too sudden and physical to be contained in the half-human vessel of her body. It pours over into scrambling backwards as far as she can get on the bed until her back collides with the wall, another lurch of nausea upending her as she processes that she's trapped. Still, neither of them have drawn their weapons. Because they know she's trapped, she surmises, and grasps frantically for the Hunmun for any sort of shield. Drawing a blade would be foolish, not when she will not lift a hand against them, but she does not want to die. Only the strands of it are somehow altered, harmonic where she used to know the melody by heart, and the Honmun's off-kilter throb shatters her focus. Her hands are empty. She has her fists. She will not lift a hand against them. Rumi's breath comes in short, economic bursts. Her body has already decided it is running for its life. It hasn't quite caught up to the fact that Rumi has nowhere to go. "Rumi," Mira says, her voice disconcertingly gentle. "What's wrong?" It feels like she's being mocked. "What do you mean, what's wrong?" Rumi demands, before she can think better of the provocation. She would do well not to make them angrier at her than they must already be. Everything is too close to the surface of her, as though she has succeeded, finally, in peeling away her patterned skin to find out that she is someone better, purer, underneath. She had not thought, when this day came, that Mira would mock her. "Do what you have to do, but don't..." Her voice cracks. The flash of anger keels over halfway through her sentence, like a wind-up toy clattering, used up, to the floor. Don't make fun of me about it, please, she rasps, embarrassed by her hoarseness. She can't look Mira in the eye. I'm just sorry I never told you, but you can see why I never did, right? Oni, Zoe says. She takes a step closer, her hands outstretched, and then freezes when Rumi flinches involuntarily. Zoe's eyes go very wide in response. What are you talking about? You sound like... You know what I'm talking about, Rumi says. She had thought, when she was putting the words in order, that they would come out sounding frustrated, but instead there is a hollowness to her voice she had not known she was capable of. She knows, she supposes, that she is defeated. Still, her heart hammers, like her body has not understood what her mind already does. Rumi lifts a hand to gesture demonstratively at the patterns across her cheeks, and then, when she spots the back of her hand and the iridescent markings painted there too, holds it out with a disdainful sort of scorn. This... Rumi, Mira says again. Her voice is low, soft, like it's intended to be grounding. We know. We did it. You're fine. We talked about it. Don't you... She hesitates, and her expression goes on tour to confusion and eureka, before flying back home, private jet style, to trepidation. She says, her voice wavering, "Don't you remember?" She doesn't. She knows she doesn't. She knows that something is wrong. She has not escaped once that being eaten at sensation, a dulled gnawing at the back of her mind without any pain, like what she imagines it must feel like to be carved into, anesthetized, but awake. She can feel the way her memory slips through her fingers and darts away, like the silver glint of a quick fish through muddy water. She remembers that she trusts her girls with N-1 things for any given N. And they haven't. They can see. Plainly, they can see her, and there are no weapons drawn. Rumi says, shaking, I don't remember. Something's wrong with my memory. Something's wrong with me. Oni, Rumi, hey, you need to breathe, Zoe says. She abandons the honorifics when she's flustered. Rumi's name sits naked and faintly Americanized on her tongue, a new and delightful sort of belonging still. Breathe, come on, deep breaths, in and out. Yeah, just like that, Rumi. Slower, she mimes an exaggerated breath. Zoe babbles when she's worried, when she wants to help. But here it's soothing. The quick rush of her words is an onslaught Rumi knows how to sink into, the river pretty bubbling of her voice like over creek stones. We're not going to... We already know, yeah? See? We've... She inches closer to Rumi, who has nowhere to go, nowhere to scramble further away. And so Rumi just stays pinned in place as Zoe holds out her hand, palm up. She does not yank Rumi's hand into hers, only leaves her small, calloused hand there, outstretched, and waits for Rumi to take it. A too long breath later, Rumi reaches back. Zoe traces her fingers over the patterns there, A mortifying arraignment, a being peeled open sensation, like every worst part of Rumi is being broadcast on MTV at once. And then leans down, holding blistering eye contact with Rumi, and kisses her knuckles gently. Rumi is still trembling. She does not know what to do with that. "We did it," Zoe says, her voice sweet and earnest with a dark sort of grace, her lips ghosting against the dry skin of Rumi's fingers. "We did it, Rumi. We saved the world." "If we did it, then why am I still fucking..." Rumi feels the word snag in her throat, the anger in her disarmed by Zoe's unexpected tenderness, unseated. She has not felt this angry in a long time, thinks it is fear transmuted into anger, or shame, maybe. But it feels so odd for it to be pouring out of her like this. She's good at not showing when she's angry. That's, like, her number one thing. Rumi dressed up as Elsa once when the three of them did a Halloween livestream in Disney princess costumes. Mila had made a surprisingly arresting Mulan, and honestly, she really did resonate. Which was silly, maybe, but Elsa was kind of cooking with that whole conceal don't feel thing. An ugly laugh congeals in Rumi's throat. "Rumiya," Mila says, and she's closer too now, perched on the edge of the bed and Zoe's side. "You're, like, freaking out." "Thanks," Rumi says, pitchily. "I noticed." Mira and Zoe share a panicked look. Rumi feels herself pressing her lips together, but does not know what expression she's trying to avoid making, only that it must be a snarled-up, unflattering thing, too complicated to let live. No both sides-ing its way out of this one. Then Mira, uncoordinated in a way she rarely is, shuffles on her knees closer to Rumi over the bed, slowly, slowly, giving Rumi every chance to scramble away. Rumi doesn't. She won't. She wants to. Mira reaches out, jerky, a little stilted somehow, and settles one long arm around Rumi's shoulders, then the other. Very slowly, she pulls Rumi into the type of hug that only Mira can give. A substitute for deep pressure therapy or Temple Grandin's cattle press machine thing. A consistent sort of crushing. Insistent. Demanding. Like she will not let Rumi slip through her fingers. Again, some part of Rumi adds. She does not remember what that means. The fight is melting out of her. In its wake is a long-lived, bone-deep exhaustion, settling into all the places she has been touched and soothed and reassured. "I'm," Rumi says, hoarse, not quite panicky anymore. She doesn't think she can muster the energy for more fear. "What am... I'm... you're..." She gestures inarticulately at herself, as best she can, with Mira still crushing her shoulders like a hydraulic press, as Rumi slumps patterned and unslaughtered into her touch. "Oni," Zoe says, and she takes Rumi's hand into hers again, a thumb grazing over the highlighted glimmer of her knuckles. "What year do you think it is?" "I don't know," Rumi grits out, because it frustrates her, it frightens her, because she feels like she's admitting to some kind of failure. Easier if this memory defect was a blunt-edged thing, a clean break. Instead, she has the blurry edges of the fog. "It's not... It seems wrong that it's 2026, but I don't remember what it should be instead. Just... less." She swallows hard, then says, "And I'm not meant to have... these." She still can't say patterns. "Everywhere. I don't remember that." "They're, like, relatively new," Mira says. Her voice vibrates through both of them, resonating, even now, a little beyond the boundaries of the physical world. "The spreading, I mean." "The spreading isn't," Rumi says. Her words come out very small. It's always been growing. I used to have nightmares that I'd wake up exactly like this." Zoe's face twists, and she opens her mouth to say something before closing it again, seeming faintly anguished by her own inability to say anything that could possibly make that better. "It's fine." Rumi gets it. Mira hums low and soothing against her skin again, the shimmer of her voice a richly coloured thing. And the air answers. It feels off-kilter, harmonic, just the way it had before. but Rumi knows the sensation. The Hunmun is tied to Zoe and Mira and every living thing and the sound of every living voice, a tapestry shepherded into its weave by the sound the three of them make together, and it's tangled somehow where it connects to Rumi. Knotted. She had not noticed it before because it had felt different in an all-encompassing way. And it is, the colours all wrong, the tenor of it altered somehow from what Rumi remembers. But now that Mira's low voice has coaxed the shape of it out into the light, there's a second difference in the way it attaches to Rumi's throat. From the way Zoe's brow furrows, only one of those differences is normal. Mira frowns, reaching for the tangled threads, and hums sotto voce as she runs her fingers through them like teasing a comb through Rumi's unbound, tangled hair. Gentle, patient, until at last the strands align. It comes at Rumi like a car driving head-on at you out of the fog. First, its shape and a sense of weight and mass, and then the fact that it is rapidly approaching, and then colour, identity, sound. She chokes on her own gasp. The settling back is overwhelming, plunges her through ice into boiling water, a black blossoming of fire behind her eyelids. She had been having nightmares. She always has nightmares. She could not sleep. She had been working with the new Hunmun that day, learning the new flexibility to its shapes, the way she could trail her fingers through the strings and tug them into different patterns through their resonance with her own. She had been dreaming of their one, disastrous takedown performance, and the way Junyu had smiled as he was taken, and the shatteredness to Mira's eyes, the horrible, resolute set to Zoe's lips, as they raised their weapons at her. She had wished she could not remember. She had sung herself a lullaby because she was not a child to wake someone else to do it for her. It had worked. As she fell asleep, she could feel her memory laying itself to rest, sweeping itself beneath a Hunmun-woven carpet. She had not known she could hex herself. She wishes, for a moment, that Mira had not undone it. The heaviness settles back onto her chest, a great dark crouching thing, and Rumi's body, which had stilled at last in Mira's arms, gives another faint tremble, like it is learning again how to bear the weight of everything she has given up. The sound she makes is small, guilty, unconcealed. Mira holds her tighter, and in Rumi's periphery, Zoe hurtles towards them, genuinely impressive that she can build up that much speed shuffling awkwardly across Rumi's bed, until she can latch onto Rumi from behind like a koala, her face tucked neatly into the space between Rumi's neck and shoulder against the exposed skin there. Her lips brush Rumi's patterns. The rush is gentle, electric. Rumi remembers, now, but for a moment the ghost of her past sits inside her body and insists that it is new, impossible, important, to be loved for what she is, rather than in spite of it. "We got you," Mira mumbles. She sounds a little teary. Rumi, possessed by an unbearable fondness, a gratitude that might break her, squeezes Mira's midsection as tightly as she can. Even with her Hunmun-enhanced strength, she doesn't even approach Mira's level of crushing hug, but it's the thought that counts. You're safe. She sounds abjectly horrified by the reminder that Rumi had, at one point, not believed it. That for so long, Rumi had given them every part of her, save for one. "You're okay." "I am," Rumi agrees, almost more for Mira's benefit than her own. But the words catch chalky in her throat. Her fingers tighten where they're fisted in Mira's loose pajama shirt. She feels the childlike urge to burrow as close into her girl's bodies as she can get, to cling to them, to let herself be held. Behind her, Zoe makes a small noise somewhere between satisfied and anguished.
"I am! I'm okay! That was stupid, huh?"
"What was?" Mira says, and even though Rumi can't see her face, she knows the exact expression Mira's making. Eyes narrowed, lips a firm, straight slash.
"It wasn't on purpose," Rumi says.
Then, embarrassed by it,
I couldn't sleep. I sang myself a lullaby with the sauce, with extra, she feels inarticulate. I wanted to just stop remembering for a bit. And hey, the good news is that it worked.
Oh my god, Zoe says, exhausted, the irritation in her voice undercut by the fondness that Rumi clings to like a lifeline.
She feels Zoe thunk her head against Rumi's back. Oh my god, or you could have just, like, come and hung out instead of hexing yourself on purpose.
It wasn't on purpose.
Next time just come wake me up for movie night, Mira scolds. The tension in her voice is at odds with the way she crushes Rumi tighter still, to the point that it's starting to get a little bit actually painful. Still, Rumi lets herself melt into it. She's allowed. She's fine. This affection is freely given. There are no false pretenses upon which it's built. N minus zero. Just N.
We could, like, have a sleepover.
We live in the same apartment, Rumi says. Lounge sleepover, Zoe says, her face still buried between Rumi's shoulder blades. Next time, if you can't sleep. Okay, honey? There's a plaintiveness to her voice that it sounds like she's trying hard to conceal, but the waver on okay is very telling. Not just, you don't have to do everything by yourself, she mumbles, muffled. Rumi swallows hard around the lump in her throat and feels it clear. She had made herself, for most of her life, into somebody who was good at being alone, into someone who was capable of it, prepared for its inevitability. But both of her girls cling to her like the thought of it is abhorrent, and she thinks of being that girl who had been that afraid, that somehow younger version of herself who could not remember she was loved and, worse, better, known, and parts her lips and hums slowly because she does not know what else to do with it. She feels the honmun sing back. This is another kind of lullaby, putting to sleep, to rest, the part of her who had feared discovery. Setting her aside, going on without her from here. Zoe hums back first, the resonance of it vibrating through Rumi's ribcage and across into Mira's body too. Then Mira laughs wetly before she opens her mouth to sing too, wordless, lilting, something you might sing to a child who couldn't sleep. There are no lyrics. Rumi has had enough of the hunter's lullaby. This is just music. Without demand or expectation or promise. Her girls find her harmony. They always do. The end. Thank you for listening.